What about women who come to you and ask about first-time sex? What are some tips or tricks that you tell women about having first-time sex, or wish that you could tell all women about having first-time sex?
I think I practiced a long time in Texas. That's where I did all my training and main portion of my private practice. And I often not get people to my office before that. They would come in after having an experience that was either underwhelming or traumatic. But if I could tell people one thing, it would be you have to learn yourself. Like, I really, really strongly encourage people, whether I grew up in and I practiced for a long time in the middle of the Bible Belt, purity culture, all of this. So I am sensitive to the fact that some people would like to wait until marriage. I don't have feelings about that. I'm very neutral about that. But if that's the group of people that you fall into, I would really strongly encourage you to learn about your own body, explore your own body first, and that communication with your partner is key. You need to be able to talk about sex. You need to be able to talk in the bedroom. You need to be able to express how you're feeling, what's going on, feeling good, feeling bad, and have somebody who's willing to slowly move there with you and not just expect mind-blowing sex the first time.
And I think communicating about sex is hard. I'd love to, I give a lot of tips on my channel about communication, but I'm no communication expert, and I'm sure, but we communicate with our patients all the time. But do you have, tips, tricks, things that you like to tell people?
It's hard. I mean, I grew up in that culture where we didn't talk about it, and so did my husband. And so it took us a long time to get there. And I wish that was something that we had learned earlier in our relationship, but it's just being trusting and okay with vulnerability. And I think all of that just comes down to safety in the relationship. So if you're somebody who struggles with communicating about sex, you're not going to have a great experience with a one-night stand. I think one-night stand, multiple partners, whatever makes you tick is great. But if you're the person who's struggling with the communication aspect, it may not be the right time for you for that. And then within a relationship, it just starts with little things, you know? I think there's a really great sex educator who has a video where she talks about, what does she call it? Sexual currency, I think she calls it. And so it's basically like flirting and things like that through the day, expressing gratitude, appreciation to your partner, or whatever it is they like. And I think this is the primary form of foreplay for a lot of women and AFAB people, because foreplay is not necessarily physical. I think a lot of people view it that way. This is going off on a tangent, but a lot of people view foreplay as like a very physical thing, and it can be. But I also think there's a lot of headspace foreplay that goes on, especially for people who are really cerebral. And I think there's a lot of men and AMAB people who also fall into that category, but we're kind of never told that that was okay because they're supposed to be visually stimulated. But I think a lot of men actually do it up here too.
Absolutely. So I will tell you, I see so many men who come to me and they are having performance anxiety, which then cycles into poor performance, which then gets more anxiety, which then it becomes this vicious cycle. And it's in there, like a lot of it is in their head, and it's normal, right? They are going into an encounter with this, like they have to perform a certain way, and if they don't perform a certain way, they fail. Like it's like very binary for them, which is not true, right? You can, sex is not just penetration. There's so much more to it, and you can bring all of that to the bedroom. And I think there's also a lot of like joking, right, in society, like, oh, he's not like, I want a 12-inch penis, whatever, right? And so that all plays into it. So absolutely, there's a lot of headspace that goes into it, right? And in both parties.
I've seen a lot of varying data and opinions on this, but how do you feel about porn and the way that it can negatively or maybe positively impact performance for people who have penis?
Yeah, I mean, I think just like I said, it makes these really unrealistic expectations of what sex is going to be like and how you should perform and how women respond if you're in a heterosexual relationship. And when you watch porn, it's usually, and a lot of people who watch it will watch things that they're not actually ever going to do in real life, which sometimes are maybe more aggressive, more violent, more out there, right? And so that can have a negative impact, but I don't like to shame people. I think there are many, many people who use pornography safely and are able to like have a wonderful sex life, enjoy their partner, enjoy their sex life, and still watch pornography recreationally. So I think that, not everyone has a problem with it. They realize that it's separate. I really worry about like our kids' generation because it's so accessible.
Some of the best moments in life are spontaneous, unplanned. But for men dealing with moderate to severe erectile dysfunction, or ED, preparing for intimacy can rob you and your partner of spontaneity. The joy of living in the moment. Now you can restore that spark in your relationship with the AMS 700 implant, a clinically proven permanent solution designed for your satisfaction and your partner's. It's the number one physician-preferred implant. It's built to look and feel natural. Happy partners agree. 92% of patients and 96% of their partners report sexual activity with the implant excellent or satisfactory. It gives you the ability to respond to your partner's wishes in the moment, not minutes or hours later. The AMS 700. No pills, no injections, no waiting. For more information, visit edcure.org/podcast. That's edcure.org/podcast. Sponsored by Boston Scientific.
I think it's extremely comparable to alcohol. There's lots of people who drink and it's no big deal. Mm-hmm. But if you fall in a category where it's either problematic or you become aggressive when you drink or it's an addiction, like there's so many ways that it can become a negative thing. And I feel the same. One of those ways is similarly to alcohol, early exposure and continued early use throughout the teen years, which is scary. Yeah. With our kids' generation of what do you think is the answer to that? Because we can't fix it.
Making pornography a discussion, right, with your child, which is really hard to do because we don't talk about sex, but saying like you're going to probably come across videos that you might have questions about that might seem very interesting to you. And I'd love to talk and answer those questions for you. And I think, you know, the same thing with masturbation, pornography, we as a culture, the gut reaction is don't ever do that. Turn that off. That's disgusting. Right. Mm-hmm. And people immediately become shameful.
Yeah.
Right.
It's very internalizing. Yeah. It's
very quickly. And so I think that's something we have to shy away from. And I think, unfortunately, whether they see it in our home, they see it with their friend's phone, they see it wherever. Right. Like they're going to see it.
Right.
So we just have to cope with that.
Yeah. In my years of parenting, I think the number one thing I think has made a big difference in helping my kids in situations that could be a struggle, whether it was when they're a toddler and we're going out to a restaurant or whatever it is, you know, anything that could be hard, is giving them warning before so that they can set expectations and they really respond well to that. So I think that talking to your kids, just like you were saying, of you may come across videos or pictures that are, you know, it seems interesting. And then if we make it taboo, that makes it even more interesting. So, you know, ask me questions and know that, like, you probably shouldn't always be seeking them out because here's what can happen. In the same way we talk about alcohol, you know?
Right. Exactly. So this is kind of serious. Let's move back a little bit. Let's talk about, you know, a lot of people because, you know, as I mentioned earlier, like people are obsessed with penile length. And let's talk about vaginal length and how that changes during intercourse, during arousal. And
yeah, sorts of things. Well, the vagina is really quite magical, I think. And probably a lot of people in your audience would agree with that. The reason penile length is really not as much of a concern in real life as it seems to be brought out in movies and pop culture is because the vagina length changes with arousal and it accommodates whatever it needs to, from a finger to a baby. It doesn't matter. But in the absence of arousal, having, you know, a well-endowed partner, particularly from a girth standpoint, can be problematic. So the opposite, actually, I feel like is more true more often. I think people who have penises way over obsessed about size, I don't think it matters as much as people feel like.
Yeah. I mean, I think you can absolutely pleasure any partner, male or female or whatever, however they identify, with any size penis.
Because actually, I would venture to say that the penis is not a big factor in
female
pleasure for people who have a vagina, because that's not how most people will climax. So
exactly. Yeah. So I've said it like 100 times on my channel. The clitoris is the most reliable route to orgasm and pleasure. So, you know,
absolutely.
You're not hitting that with a penis.
So start there and then you can expand into other things once you are real comfortable there.
Yeah. You know, we hear about like retroverted uteruses, anteroverted uteruses. How does that play into pleasure or discomfort during sex?
Not a lot, probably. I explain anteroverted and retroverted uterus in patients, like when I'm talking to them, as being left or right-handed. Most people are right-handed. Some people are left-handed. That would be equivalent to retroverted uterus. It doesn't really make a difference. It's not caused by anything. It's not negative or positive. But you do have a higher incidence of retroversion in people who have severe endometriosis because the uterus can get scarred to the back wall of the pelvis. So in that situation, then certainly you would see a overlap, but more of a confounding factor of people having a retroverted uterus and it causing more pain with deep penetration and things like that, but more because of the endo, not the placement.
Let's do a quick discussion of endo. I know there's many women who are affected with it, and it is a very life-altering diagnosis. And I'm sure if there are partners who have partners with it, or there are women listening who have it, they'd love to learn a little bit more about it.
Yeah.